We have, I think, Zafar Benkash on the line. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I'm with you.
Hey, thanks very much. Zafar, you're the key man, the go-to on so many topics. But
I think that's the thing. That's why I think you...
So we want to know, first of all, about Prime Minister Imran Khan. Why is he still in jail? I heard that he won his appeal, that they had agreed that he shouldn't be there. What's the situation?
Well, you see, the problem is that he has been charged with something like 180 different charges. So even
180?
180. And the amazing thing is that, before, in his 70-year existence, there was not a single case or charge of any wrongdoing against him. But once, the military orchestrated his removal from office on the orders of the Americans, then they have slapped something like 180 charges against him. And as they go through the very, very corrupt judicial system, even that corrupt judicial system is unable to prove any wrongdoing on his part. I will give you an example. For instance, he was accused of leaking state secrets in what is referred to as the Cipher case. This related to a coded message that Pakistan's ambassador in Washington, D.C., had sent to the Foreign Office, as it was his duty to do, after he had met a State Department official, one Donald Liu, who told the Pakistani ambassador that unless you remove Imran Khan from office, you are going to face very serious difficulty. And so the ambassador communicated this message to the Foreign Office, and Imran Khan, in a public gathering, said that we have been threatened by a foreign government. He didn't name the foreign government. He said, we've been threatened by a foreign government that, my government should be removed because the Americans are unhappy with us. And he basically waved a piece of paper addressing a public rally. Now, but the normal procedure is that when a cipher letter is received from abroad, there are specialists in the Foreign Office who would translate it into English, and the gist of that content would be communicated to the Prime Minister, to the Foreign Minister, a number of other officials in the country. And when Imran Khan was removed from office, he was accused of revealing state secrets in terms of sort of talking about, America threatening Pakistan and demanding my ouster, etc. Now, this is the amazing thing, that he was arrested, as was the foreign minister, his foreign minister at the time. Both are still in prison. And the army chief who actually carried out the American orders is free. Nobody says anything to him. So, mm-hmm. Of course, this matter dragged on in court. The judges basically, withheld their judgment. They said, we reserve our judgment. Ultimately, last week, the Lahore High Court said that, no state secrets were revealed, that Imran Khan simply communicated what was a fact, and that he is not guilty of anything like that. And yet he remains in prison because he faces other charges. But the additional point is that the courts are so much under influence of the military that the Lahore High Court judge who dismissed this case against Imran Khan, that judge himself was dismissed from his position. So you see what is...
He has himself been dismissed?
Sorry?
The judge himself has been dismissed?
Yes, he was actually removed from that position and transferred somewhere else.
Somebody's judging the judges.
Exactly, yes.
Oh my
and that's,
God.
Of course, the military. They're dictating these things. And then you have the Supreme Court Chief Justice, who is completely you know, under the control of the military, the intelligence agencies. He meets the, you know, intelligence chief or his representatives regularly and takes orders from them. So regrettably, we have a situation in Pakistan where there is de facto martial law, but these military men hide behind this facade that they have a civilian government in power and they are the ones that are making decisions, when in fact all decisions are being made by the military. And mm-hmm. this has had horrendous negative consequences for Pakistan. There is social and political turmoil. The economy is in very, very deep trouble. It has nosedived. And you know, thousands of people are languishing in prison. And I want to mention to you with respect to what they are doing with Imran Khan, whom many people still consider to be the legitimate prime minister of Pakistan. He is being kept in a cell which measures about 5 feet by 9 feet. It's a death row cell. He's not committed a murder, and yet he's being kept over there. And in the last few weeks, temperatures have been soaring so high in Pakistan, they've been touching something like 45 to 47 degrees centigrade. It's absolute murder, the heat that has gripped Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And in that cell where Imran Khan is kept, there is obviously no air conditioning. There is what the government refers to as a water cooler. It's basically a fan that draws air from the outside. Mm-hmm. But that water cooler is installed in the washroom, the toilet. Now, I want to, for the benefit of your listeners, I want to explain that toilet basically comprises, there is a toilet, but it's not a toilet seat kind of toilet, which has a P-trap, so yeah. The smell from the sewer doesn't come through. It's a what is referred to as the Indian-style toilet, where you squat on the floor, and of course the smell from the sewer comes straight out. Mm. So this water cooler fan is installed right behind this toilet, so all that stink from the toilet comes into the small cell that Imran Khan is kept in. And this is being done deliberately to punish him.
This is someone who got the most votes. His party to lead the country.
Exactly, the person who got the most votes in the country.
And by the way, he now has a party. That party is the largest party, right?
Exactly. Theoretically, it is the largest party, but it cannot exist as a party because the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice, basically refused to allocate them the symbol, their electoral symbol. So all of his candidates had to participate in elections as independents. And of course, they made an alliance with another party, but you know, the courts are continuing to act on the orders of the military and trying to suppress this party's strength in parliament. Yeah. You see, the way the system is set up, that the parties, each party basically contests elections on what are called regular seats, which mm-hmm. are about 266 seats. And then there are about 70 seats that are called reserve seats. So whatever number of seats a particular party has won in parliament, then it is given a proportional share of the reserved seats. These include seats reserved for women as well as for minorities, religious minorities. So Imran Khan's party is denied even these seats because the government alleges the Election Commission, which is, of course, again, under the control of the military, and the courts conniving with it by saying, well, Imran Khan's party is not a party because these people were elected as independents. Although the Constitution allows them to join another party in parliament so that they can basically form an electoral alliance and have those seats allocated to them. But, you know, the way the system is rigged, Yeah. The Election Commission denies them those seats. Imran Khan's lawyer lodged a case in court. The courts are violating this thing. In fact, there was last week there were hearings in court, and Imran Khan's lawyers pleaded with the judges. This was in the Supreme Court, saying mm-hmm. that these seats should be allocated to the party that Imran Khan's party has made an alliance with. And the Supreme Court judge said, well, why didn't Imran Khan's party candidates run under their own symbol? And the lawyer tried to remind him that, you know, Your Honor, you were the one who banned and turned down that request in this very court that, you know, they cannot have that symbol. And the Chief Justice sitting there, he says, no, they could have, you know, got these seats. Each independent candidate could have got that symbol on his own. The other judges had to intervene to remind the Chief Justice that you yourself had prevented them from getting this symbol. And now you are saying, why didn't they get this symbol? These are the kinds of idiotic things that are going on over there.
Yes.
They have turned the country into a laughing stock. It has become a beggar nation. They are begging for money because they don't have any, and they've gone to the IMF that has imposed very, very stringent conditions on giving them additional money. They demand that taxes should be increased, prices of fuel and food should be increased, which is basically crippling the poor man because, you know, all of these are essentially indirect taxes that are passed on to the poor, and the rich obviously don't pay any tax at all in Pakistan.
Sounds like United States. We're speaking to Zafar Bengash.
That's the model they follow. Yeah.
I got to ask you one question further about this. Two questions with you. First one is in finding out, so they are, somebody's doing a good job of, I think, of maintaining a Twitter or X account for Imran Khan, and I assume one can rely on that as roughly accurate. I'm asking about the accuracy. But the second thing is that on that account, he said two things recently. He spoke out about the treatment of the Palestinians and how there had to be action taken to end the siege of Gaza and all that, which I was impressed with, and I think the world should know he's saying these things. The second thing is that he has raised an issue which must be very sensitive in Pakistan, and that is the subject has come up about how the army had a civil war among themselves over the loss of East Pakistan.
Yes, of course. Imran Khan is able to send out messages on X, or the former Twitter, as it was called.
People should follow that, right?
Exactly. Since his family, as well as some of his lawyers, are able to meet him very, very briefly in prison. In fact, when he was the prime minister, there were two issues that he constantly raised. One was the issue of Kashmir under Indian occupation, and the second was Palestine under Israeli occupation. And he had been very clear, very forceful throughout his term as prime minister or when he was in office. And he has continued to speak out about these things whenever he gets an opportunity. Now, you raised the issue of the loss of East Pakistan when the Pakistan army surrendered. This is, of course, you know, one of the really, really incredible things is that not a single army officer was tried for that horrific crime that they perpetrated in East Pakistan against the civilian population, and then ultimately they surrendered to the invading Indian army. And, of course, you know, the generals keep on saying, well, this was the politician's fault. The former army chief, before he left office, he said, well, it wasn't our fault. It was the politicians who failed, etc. Yet he conveniently ignored the fact that it was the army chief at the time, General Yahya Khan, who was the chief martial law administrator. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he was all in all. Number two, he had also made himself the president. He remained the army chief, and he was the one who refused to negotiate with Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, who was the leader of the largest political party in Pakistan at the time. Of course, all his seats were from East Pakistan, former East Pakistan, which is today Bangladesh. But that does not negate the fact that his party had won an absolute majority in the National Assembly, and he was entitled to become the prime minister and govern the country. But these brute generals, they simply could not accept that, that somebody from East Pakistan would be ruling the country, because they thought Pakistan is only made for the West Pakistani elite and the East Pakistani people have no right to rule the country. And they engineered this crisis. They thought that they could crush the people's aspirations.
Civilian leadership was overruled by generals.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
He's reminding them of a fatal mistake.
Exactly. In fact, today, many commentators in Pakistan have drawn parallel between what the generals did in 1971 with the largest political party at that time, the Awami League, led by Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, who incidentally was also arrested and put in jail. And, you know, he was being charged with treason. The same thing is happening to Imran Khan today. Many commentators in Pakistan have pointed parallels between the two, and they are saying that the army is once again playing with fire in order to preserve their illegitimate hold on power, that they keep on conquering their own people periodically. They cannot fight the real enemy, which is India. And, you know, they have bankrupted the economy. They have driven the country into oblivion. Pakistan has become a laughingstock, and if they continue on this path, many commentators have actually expressed grave fears that perhaps the country may not even survive because the divisions are so deep in the country today.
And of course, he represents a people's solution. Let's have the party that is most popular with the people make the decisions and get us out of this problem, right?
Exactly.
All these generals have agendas about which we know nothing.
That's correct. You see, Imran Khan's party is the only party in the country that has representation from all four provinces of Pakistan. No other political party has that kind of support. In fact, that has deliberately been engineered by the military. They didn't want Imran Khan's party to win that many seats, but the people came out overwhelmingly, and despite massive rigging, the people showed that they wanted to vote for Imran Khan. Yeah. And as a consequence, his party has got seats in all the provinces. The other parties have got seats only in selected provinces. So his party is the only one that represents the sentiment of the people of the whole country. And yet these brute generals would not allow his party to govern as it is their right, and they keep on interfering in political affairs. They've made a mess of everything. I wish they were smart enough to be able to manage the country. I think then the people would be happy about it. But they are not smart. They are you know, basically quite dumb.
Yes. Just because they have their own interests that about which we don't talk. We don't know what a group of what powerful families they support, what region, at least it isn't talked about openly, but clearly they are playing politics in their own field, right?
Exactly.
I mean, generals are historically very political. There's no general that isn't a politician anywhere in the world.
Unfortunately, the Pakistani generals are more political than most generals in the world.
Yes.
And they're also very corrupt. You see, they have what is called the Fauji Foundation. Fauj, of course, is the Urdu word for army. So it's the army or military foundation. And it has been designated as a charitable organization, so they don't pay any tax. They have assets worth $53 billion inside the country. They own, you know, they own cement factories, they own agricultural lands, they own farms, they own they even, you know, make conflicts. One wonders, you know, what has the army got to do with making conflicts? Mm-hmm. And the Fauji Foundation employs 300,000 people. These are all ex-army officers or, you know, soldiers, etc., that are employed in various capacities. They own factories, they own, you know, banquet halls, they own hotels.
Oh, my gosh.
And now they are even grabbing, you know, Pakistan's mineral resources, etc. So, in other words, they treat Pakistan as their private fiefdom, that they can do whatever they like. And mm-hmm. most of the generals in Pakistan are billionaires. They've got bank accounts abroad. Most of their children, family members are all citizens of other countries,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's the U.S. U.S. is their preferred choice. Canada also is a favorite destination, Australia, England.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're all over the place.
Yeah. Now, thank you very much for all that on the Pakistan. By the way, I'm glad you clarified. I do think people should follow him on Twitter so they know they're clear what the issues are. I want to ask you, there's an important election coming up in the Islamic Republic. And by the way, everybody here says, oh, it's just mullahs, et cetera. But boy, everyone wants to know who are the candidates. And what do you know about the upcoming election?
Well, the elections are going to be held on June 28th. I'm sure your listeners would be aware that on May the 19th, there was a helicopter crash in which the former president, foreign minister, and a number of other officials were killed. This was in North Iran on the border with Azerbaijan.
Mm-hmm.
And so the constitution requires that new elections have to be held within 50 days. Mm-hmm. And there are six candidates that are going to be contesting the elections. One of the candidates is the current parliamentary speaker. The other is the former nuclear negotiator. Another member is the mayor of Tehran. One of them is a former justice minister. Another one is, he was the health minister. And there is one other candidate who used to be a parliamentarian. Now he isn't, but he is the head of the Veterans and Martyrs Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the people come actually with very, very good credentials.
Well, you know, this president really seemed to be an excellent leader, the deceased president. Are his interests, his point of view, reflected in any of these candidates? And how is it the way we see it in the West? People talk about it. They say there are the so-called reformers, or the ones who would really prefer a middle course, and then there are those who have become very adamant about confronting the U.S., particularly in Gaza and elsewhere. Do you know how they break these candidates?
Well, you see, all of the candidates, in their they filed their nomination papers, they have all spoken of continuing the policy and the legacy of the former president, and they have all spoken very highly of him, and they have said that he was pursuing the right policy, which was for the interest and benefit of the people of Iran, as well as of all the oppressed people in the world, particularly people in Palestine and Gaza. And so they have all vowed to continue that policy. So in that sense, all of the candidates are totally committed to that particular line. Obviously, you know, there are, the background of each of these candidates in many instances are very similar, because many of them are war veterans. They fought the war. They participated in the eight-year war against Iraq when it was ruled by Saddam Hussein. But some of them, like particularly, for instance, Kalibaf, who's the current Speaker of Parliament, he had also served as the Air Force Chief. Then he was the mayor of Tehran for about 10 years or so, and he did absolutely remarkable, mm-hmm. work as the mayor of Tehran. He built many highways, because Iran has, a lot of traffic mm-hmm. congestion issues. He built highways all across the city. He launched a very vigorous tree planting campaign to make sure that, the city looks green and beautiful. People who have visited, Tehran in recent years will testify to the fact that it was always a very beautiful city, but, you know, under Kalibaf, he really improved it tremendously. And there's also, of course, the underground subway system in Tehran. So he did a number of things that obviously people remember fondly.
Yep.
These very people-friendly policies.
So I'm afraid
in that sense, he may be the favorite. I don't know, but
We'll watch this closely, and we're going to ask you, Zafar Benghash. Thank you very, very much. It's a great pleasure to talk to you.
It's my pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
Okay. Hey, I want to thank Winston and Pedro for taking care of us. And 33, 45, 78, Steve Fruitman is coming up.